words are amazing things. They have the ability to make us laugh or cry, to give us hope. They have the ability to sometimes make you give up hope. You never want to underestimate the power of words. Let me read a couple of quotations I pulled up. These are some interesting words spoken by various people. Lawrence Peters said, "Speak when you're angry, and you'll make the best speech you'll ever regret." A couple of unknown sources. This guy says, "If someone were to pay you 10 cents for every kind word you ever spoke and collect from you 5 cents for every unkind word, would you be rich or poor?" Another guy, you'll recognize this one, Mark Twain says, it takes your enemy and your friend working together to hurt you to the heart. The one to slander you and the other to get the news to you. Pretty profound. Here's a comedian, Eric Idle. He says, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will make me go in the corner and cry by myself for hours." And then Dale Carnegie said, "Any fool can criticize, condemn, and complain, and most fools do." And then there's some encouraging words. These are out of the Scriptures, out of Proverbs. You have, "Anxiety in the heart of a man can cause depression, but a good word makes it glad." And King Solomon, who was the wisest man that ever lived, said this, "Death and life are in the power of the tongue." Words are really powerful. There's two necessary factors that make words powerful. So words are just, you pull out a dictionary and just a whole list of words. What makes words powerful? What changes things? Two things are necessary. One is the content, obviously, how those words are put together. What is the content? And the second is the authority behind those words. Let me say that again. To make words powerful, it involves content and authority. To be more specific, it's not the words themselves that hold the power. It's really the speaker of the words who has the power, and particularly what you believe about the speaker of the words. Misplaced belief can get you in trouble. So consider this following incident. CNN news reporter had his request approved. He's a photographer. He quickly used a cell phone to call the local airport to charter a flight. He was told a twin-engine plane would be waiting for him at the airport. So arriving at the airfield, he spotted a plane warming up outside a hangar. So he jumped in with his bag, slammed the door shut, and shouted to the pilot, "Let's go!" Pilot taxied out, swung the plane into the wind, and took off. And once in the air, the photographer instructed the pilot, "I want you to fly over the valley. I want you to make low passes so I can take pictures of the fires on the hillsides." Pilot responded, "Why?" He said, "Because I'm a photographer for CNN and I want to get some close-up shots." To which the pilot responded, after being strangely silent for a few moments, "So what you're telling me is you're not my instructor." Words are important. Belief in who's speaking the words, very important. Words have to have content and authority to be effective. You've probably had several different people in your life of authority who have spoken powerful words. I'll mention a couple that you've probably had. Suppose you have an employer, you're in sales, and your employer comes to you and says, "Here's the deal, you hit this benchmark in sales, and at the end of the year, you get a $50,000 bonus." Well, because that's your employer, and that person has the content, $50,000, if you hit this level of sales, and the authority to back that up, those words have meaning. They will motivate you. Most of us have had coaches growing up. Coaches definitely have the power to motivate you, especially if you don't do what's right. You could run stadiums or whatnot. Now, next month, in November, we're going to have Jerry Leachman speaking back here, and he's going to be speaking at Birmingham Country Club, so you'll get an invite to that. How many of y'all have heard Jerry Leachman speak before? Let me see. Yeah, so most of you. Jerry's a funny guy, unless you're in junior high, which I was, and he's your coach. So he's my teacher, and I'm cutting up in class, which is not a good thing to do under Jerry, because Jerry's a pretty straightforward guy. And so after asking me to knock it off a couple times, Jerry said, "Mr. Singletary can't seem to keep his pie hole shut. So I need Mr. Singletary to come on up front, and I'm going to demonstrate how I can shut his pie hole." And I knew what was coming, and it wasn't going to be good. And Jerry took out one of those, you know, cheese board paddles and applied it to my backside and sent me right into the chalkboard. And that did it for me. I really did not disrupt his class anymore that day. He had power. How about parents? Parents can and should have power in our lives. So probably many of you here are parents. I've got a couple of kids. My youngest is off at school, and you know, she's my princess. And so she's a very attractive young woman, and she's in the dating scene. So I have words to guys who would want to date her. And I came upon this. This was really good. I thought these words were very, very powerful. So I thought, I'm going to adopt this. This is going to be my go-to sheet if anybody wants to date my daughter. So I came up on this application for permission to date my daughter. And I thought, this is really good. I'm going to adopt this. So here's the application. This is what it entails. So it has a place for the young man's name, date of birth, height, weight, IQ, GPA, social security number and driver's license number, Boy Scout rank and badges, home address, obviously. And there's a series of questions. Do you have parents? Yes or no. Is one male and the other female? Yes or no. If no, explain. Number of years they've been married. If this is less than your age, explain. There's a place on this application for accessories. I like this. Answer yes or no to the following. Do you have access to or own a van? A truck with oversized tires? A waterbed? A pickup with a mattress in the back? Do you have a nose ring, pierced tongue, pierced cheek, or a belly button ring? If you answered yes to any of the above, discontinue application and leave the premises immediately. Here's the essay section. In 50 words or less, I like this guy. This guy is sharp. In 50 words or less, what does late mean to you? In 50 words or less, what does don't touch my daughter mean to you? In 50 words or less, what does abstinence mean to you? Here's a reference section. Church you attend, how often you attend. When would be the best time to interview your father, your mother, your pastor? Here's a short answer section. Answer by filling in the blank. Please answer freely. All answers are confidential. If I were shot, the last place I would want to be shot would be. If I were beaten, the last bone I would want broken is my. The one thing I hope this application does not ask me about is. What do you want to do if you grow up? When I meet a girl, the thing I always notice about her first is, and what is the current going rate of a hotel room? Now, to prepare for this interview, you need to prepare yourself by studying Daddy's 8 Rules for Dating. So here's Daddy's 8 Rules for Dating. These are priceless. If you pull into my driveway and honk, you better be delivering a package because you're sure not picking anything up. Rule 2. You do not touch my daughter in front of me. You may glance at her, so long as you do not peer at anything below her neck. If you cannot keep your eyes or hands off my daughter's body, I will remove them. Rule 3, I'm aware it's considered fashionable for boys of your age to wear trousers so loose that they appear to be falling off your hips. Please do not take this as an insult, but you and all of your friends are complete idiots. Still, I want to be fair and open-minded about this issue, so I propose this compromise. In order to ensure that your clothes do not, in fact, come off during the course of a date with my daughter, I'm going to take my nail gun and fasten your trousers in place. Rule 4. I'm sure you've been told that in today's world, sex without utilizing a barrier method of some kind can kill you. Let me elaborate. When it comes to sex, I am the barrier, and I will kill you. Rule 5. If you make her cry, I'll make you cry. Rule 6, as you stand in my front hallway waiting for my daughter to appear and more than 1 hour goes by, do not sigh or fidget. If you want to be on time for the movie, you shouldn't be dating. My daughter is putting on her makeup, a process that can take longer than painting the Golden Gate Bridge. So instead of just standing there, why don't you do something useful like change the oil in my car? Rule 7, do not lie to me. I may appear to be middle-aged, dim-witted, has-been, but on issues relating to my daughter, I am the all-knowing, merciless God of your universe. If I ask you where you're going and with whom, you have one chance to tell me the truth. I have a shotgun, a shovel, access to 5 acres. Do not trifle with me. And the last rule, be afraid. Be very afraid. I'm from a military family. It takes very little for me to mistake the sound of your car in my driveway for a chopper coming in over a rice paddy in Hanoi. As soon as you pull into the driveway, you should exit the car with both hands in plain sight. Speak the perimeter password. Announce in a clear voice that you have brought my daughter home safely and early. Then return to your car. There's no need for you to come inside. The camouflaged face at the window is mine. I like those rules for dating. Words are powerful. Parents have powerful influence on children. As we approach election day here in a couple of weeks, we're seeing a flurry of words spoken by each candidate. Some are words of promise. Some are words of accusation. Some are words of explanation. You've probably heard most of them. Make no mistake about it, the candidate who is trusted to have the most powerful words, that is, content, and the authority to back up those words, will be the one who's elected. That's what will happen. This morning, I want to take a few minutes and look at an encounter of some seasoned fishermen and the historical person of Jesus Christ. No man ever spoke more powerful words. Those were words full of content and authority. Of course, making claims about someone's words as powerful doesn't automatically make it so. But if we see authoritative action that backs up those words, then we should closely consider those. The encounter I want to briefly look at is an encounter between Jesus and some fishermen. It's recorded in the Gospel of Matthew. It's in Matthew chapter 8 and verses 23 through 27. This account is interesting for several reasons, and I want to point out just a couple of observations, but let me read these few verses to you. And when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by the waves. But he was asleep. And they went and woke him, saying, "Save us, Lord, we are about to die." And he said to them, "Why are you afraid, O you of little faith?" And he rose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was great calm. And the men marveled, saying, "Who does this? Who is this that even the winds and sea obey him?" This is what I want to look at this morning. This account is an account of powerful words spoken by Christ to some seasoned fishermen. There are some direct applications for us. I don't know what you think about the Bible, the Scriptures, but what you think about the Bible, those verses, the authoritative nature of the Bible or not, makes all the difference in the world. I would encourage you, if you've not settled that issue in your own mind, to do so. Sooner or later, all of us have to think about ultimate reality. The Scriptures have everything to say about ultimate reality. As you know, at the center, we do events like this. We do about 5 or 6 events like this every year. And then we do some smaller venues. Last year, Richard Simmons did, on a smaller venue, a series called The Reliability of the Scriptures. Hopefully some of you were able to attend that. If not, you can go to our website. You can download, I think it's 6 or 7 sessions. You can download it right up off of our website. But Richard was making the case that the Scriptures are different than any other words available to us. I don't know what you think about that, But what you think about that makes all the difference in the world. That talk, those series of talks, is being compiled into another book. So Richard put out a book a few years ago on the economy. This book's going to be out hopefully December 1, and the title will be Reliable Truth, The Validity of the Bible in an Age of Skepticism. I really encourage you to download those talks, or when the book comes out, get the book and work through it and ask yourself, do I think the Scriptures are good suggestions for decent living, or are they the authoritative Word of God that comes to pass? It's impossible to look at Scripture and say, well, that's nifty, unless you think it's good suggestions for decent living. If it's good suggestions for decent living, then okay, you could read it and you could say, that's interesting, that may be helpful, that part's not. But if you believe that the Bible is inerrant and authoritative, and that the words of the Bible are the words of God, and that He has the authority and the power to back up those words, it will change everything about your life. This morning I want to look at four observations in this encounter, these few verses that we had. I want to look at the wind, the worry, the word, and the work. I'm going to focus on the words. I'm going to move through those fairly quickly. Another way to say it, Christ comes to these fishermen and He uses a means, a method, and there's a certain mission. He's after something. He's going to speak words to these fishermen and He wants those words to do something, and they do. They accomplish a great deal. Here's the setting, just so you can get an idea of what's going on. Just prior to this, in this Gospel of Matthew, we've seen Christ move through some cities, and He's done some phenomenal things. He's healed illnesses. So lepers have come to Him, and in Jesus' day, if you had leprosy, you know, it was incurable. It got so bad you became horribly disfigured. Fingers and toes, your nose would literally come off. The people were grotesque and they would set them aside in separate communities because it's contagious. And if you get it, you're going to die a painful, slow death. He comes through and He heals a group of lepers just instantaneously. They're leprosy free. Stunning. A centurion, a Roman commander of many, comes to Him and asks for Christ to heal his servant, and He does on the spot at that moment. Christ enters one of His followers' household. This follower is going to host a group of people, and his mother-in-law is there, this follower's mother-in-law, and she's sick. And Christ heals her on the spot. She gets up and starts waiting. Healing a mother-in-law? Maybe the greatest miracle in the Bible. I don't know. And then people would be possessed by demons in Jesus' day and do feats of amazing strength, and people were terrorized by these folks. And Christ comes to these folks and with a word of content and authority casts demons out. So this is what's been happening. And now Christ is gathered. He's on the shore of a lake. Hundreds and hundreds of people have come around. There's no PA system. People are pressing in on Him so much because of what He does, and they want help. He has apparently words of massive content and massive authority, so they're pressing in on Him. He gets in a boat, pushes off a little from the shore, and that's how He teaches. He teaches the crowd, so He's just done that. Then He looks at His followers, these few fishermen, and says, let's cross over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, not a small sea. So they begin to cross over. Now, what He's going to do is He's going to demonstrate His authority over nature. That's what's getting ready to happen. So His followers, these fishermen, have seen Him and heard Him. Now He's pulling them into a smaller group on a boat, and He's going to say some things that are life-changing to them. But before He does that, something's got to happen. And that's my appeal to you this morning and to myself. Before life change happens, there's got to be a setting. Something's got to take place. We're going to look at that. So first is, they get in this boat, They head across this sea, and God does something. He brings a storm. This is the means. This is the wind. If you want to get the attention of some professional fishermen, pretty rough crowd, fishermen of that day, they were some BAs. If you want to get their attention, you've got to get them humbled a bit. So what would be a great way to do that? Well, get them out in their environment where they feel pretty confident and put them in a position where they think they're going to die. And that's exactly what happened. Sea of Galilee is about 700 feet below sea level. It's surrounded by some cliffs. And what would happen is, as winds would come in, they would drop over the hillside. And when they hit, it just immediately, storms could just rage. And that's what's happened. And God has sent this storm, particularly in this environment at this time. It's so bad that these fishermen can't control it. Waves are rocking the boat, probably a pretty decent-sized boat, because Christ is asleep in the back of the boat on a cushion. So that's a little hard to imagine. I mean, he's got to be exhausted. If there is a storm raging that is about to swamp your boat, waves are coming over, they can't bail it out fast enough, these professional fishermen are looking at this storm and saying, we're not going to make it. This is what we do for a living. We do this all every day. And this storm's so bad, we're not going to make it. And Jesus is asleep. So this wind has brought up some desperation. I wonder what might be some storms in your life. In a group this size, without a doubt, we have experienced crisis in our lives. If you haven't, you would be, you know, a rare guy here this morning that hasn't encountered some pretty major crisis in your life. It may have been back in 08, 09, your business may have completely tanked. Certainly for Over the Mountain Birmingham, we were one of the hardest hit, top 10 per capita communities hit in the nation. So I don't know how many cities are in our nation, but communities, thousands and thousands and thousands of communities in our nation. And Mountain Brook was in the top 10 per capita in financial devastation. That's a crisis. If your whole world in 08 and 09 is built on the financial industry, that was a game changer and real quickly for you. For some here this morning, it may be your marriage. Maybe your marriage is not going the way you thought it would. And it's just not looking good. There's discord with your wife at such a level that you're wondering, I don't know if we're going to make it. It's a crisis. Maybe you've got a child that is very rebellious, a teenager that is completely doing opposite of everything you think you've raised them to do, and it's just causing great grief and turmoil in your life. Or maybe a friend or a relative or a family member is sick. If a doctor walks in, if an oncologist walks in to your examination room and looks at you and says, you need to prepare yourself. You've got an inoperable tumor. That's a game changer. Because that man or woman, that doctor, has words of content and the authority to back them up, and you take those words seriously. So we all have crisis. So if you're in the middle of a crisis, it may be worth asking yourself, what is happening and is this for a reason? I would propose to you this morning that God brings crisis into our life for a reason. He brought a crisis into the life of these fishermen and he had their attention. They are about to be undone. This storm is brought about by God to highlight something these professional fishermen lacked, and he wants them to get the message. They're not going to get the message unless he's got their undivided attention, and he's now got it. Tim Keller, some of you may be familiar with Tim Keller. He's a pastor up in New York. He's written a great book on marriage called The Meaning of Marriage, and in that book, he describes a marriage as, he says, picture it like there's a creek and there's a bridge over this creek. And so when, you know, for those of us in here who are married, when you got married, you know, everybody goes down the aisle and goes to the altar, and you think that we are the exception and we are going to knock it out. Nobody goes down to the altar and says, you know, my goal for my marriage is to be completely average. You know, just to make it. We just an average marriage. Nobody does that. We start out and we say, we have the highest of hopes. Your wife was thinking that, and you were thinking that. It's like a bridge crossing this creek, and you look at that bridge and you say, the bridge is your marriage, and you say, looks great. That's why I'm signing up. I don't see any problems here. Well, that bridge has got little cracks in it, little fissures, little cracks. It's probably not detectable. What if you were to drive, Keller says, what if you were to drive a 10-ton Mack truck and now park it on that bridge? Some cracks show up. It's called crisis. Pressure coming to bear reveals some problems. That's what happens. That's what's happening with these fishermen. And here's something that I think God does. As I look at this account, often storms come up in the areas where we feel most assured. So for a businessman, if you're feeling confident about your business or about your finances, sometimes God brings a storm into your life in that arena. Because we feel like, I've got it. I've got it under control. When a crisis arises in your arena of expertise, it's humbling. You realize, man, this is my area. I thought I was on my A game. I thought I was, just last year, I was feeling very confident, and now I'm in crisis mode. That will get your attention. So usually he does that where we feel confident. Well, how did these fishermen respond? These are seasoned fishermen, and they are in panic mode. It's a little embarrassing, probably. So the second thing I want to talk about is the method or the worry. I think Christ put them in this position to get them in a place where they do not have confidence, and there's a reason for that. They come to him, they wake him up, and they give him a command. Now, I may not be a master theologian, but probably it's not the best idea to wake up God and tell him what to do. Just saying. That might not be the best thing to do. These guys don't care. They wake him up, and here's what they say. Save us. And in fact, they indict him a bit. Don't you care that we're about to die? So pretty strong words to say to a guy who heals lepers, casts out demons, performs miracles. They're telling him what to do. They're in full panic mode. This is a good place to be. This is exactly where Christ wants these guys. They are all ears. They are ready to do something. They are ready to receive a word he has to say. And that's the point. Everything else is leading up to it. Without the storm, without their life being in peril, I think Christ might have sat them down. Let's say they're just around a nice breakfast table, and he says, hey guys, got something pretty important to tell you, and I need you to pay attention this morning. Okay, yeah, what you got? Well, this is not that setting. This is a setting where they are fearing for their lives. They are desperate. And what they want is what all men want. When you're in a crisis, what do you want? You want a fix. Right? Sometimes people come to give you some advice and you go, not looking for advice, I want a solution. And the sooner, the better. Now, panic mode, fix this thing. I think that's why at the center of the various of us, George, Todd, Richard, Jay, myself, we all do some of the same things, and each of us kind of focus on a niche, so to speak. I have the privilege, and I very much consider it a privilege, to do a good bit of marriage counseling. Almost always, if I did a survey, when a couple comes to see me, The wife has been ready. She's like, been trying to get this going for a couple years. But the husband's going, oh, we're all right. Usually, there are exceptions. But usually they're saying, well, we're all right. The marriage maybe deteriorates, maybe the arguments don't go so well, and finally it gets to a place where the husband, maybe that'd be a good idea. Maybe that'd be a good idea. Why are we as men so hesitant to get advice? I don't think it's all bad. I think one answer is we want it fixed. You know, so when a couple comes in, I mean, the guy is asking, can you really help me? I don't want to just talk about it. So I'm working with a couple right now, and this is, I'm probably the second counselor they've seen. And I said, I don't want to know who you've seen before me, but what didn't go well? And this is what the husband said. Well, we spent some time. There were some decent things said. I think they were probably pretty helpful. But at the end of the day, there was no game plan. He said, that was frustrating for me. This guy, he's a problem solver. What he's telling me is, I don't mind talking about it, but at the end of the deal, I need to know what to do. I don't just want to talk about it. I want to fix. I want it to change. And he is absolutely on target. These fishermen want a fix. As guys, we want a fix. If you've got a financial issue, if you've got an addiction issue, if you've got marriage issues, children issues, what we want is a fix. That's not bad. But here's what God is usually doing before that. He's saying, I can get you a fix. But it's going to come through a word. And if you're not good and desperate, you'll miss the word. You'll want to go right to the fix, right to the work. Christ has got a captive audience on this boat. He's got seasoned fishermen that are fearing for their life. They want a fix, and that's not what he does for them. Look at what he says. So they come. You kind of have to picture in your mind the setting, because it can seem, you know, it's what's going on here? These are professional fishermen. They're in a boat. This boat is rocking. Waves are coming in. They're bailing and talking at the same time. And they are fearing that it's going to sink and they're going to drown. So this conversation is not like over a breakfast table. They are holding on to things and rocking. And they're saying, don't you care, save us. And here's what Christ does. I'm sure he's a hold of things as well. He's in the same boat. He's rocking. And he asks him a question. What? Who does that? Why would you do that? Here's the question he asked them. Why are you afraid? It seems like an odd question. Why are you afraid? You know, it's not recorded exactly what the fishermen thought at that point, but put yourself in their shoes. You can think of some pretty choice answers, right? Well, take a look around. I know you were just sleeping, but we're about to go under. We're afraid because our lives are about to end. We're about to die. What do you mean? Why are you afraid? He's asking a question because it's the best thing to do and what they most need right now at this point. They want a fix, and he's giving them a word that they need more than a fix right then. And they're all ears. He's got them. He's got a captive audience. Here's what he says, and I won't go into this in detail. You could look at it and maybe make some observations yourself. But he says, basically, you're afraid because you have little faith. He is calling out their manhood right there on that boat in the midst of what they do professionally for a living. That's humbling. It's what these guys do. And he's saying, let me tell you why you're afraid. You're afraid because you don't have faith. In other words, didn't you see me heal people with leprosy? Haven't you seen me cast out people who were demon-possessed on the spot? You've seen these things. What's this? Why are you afraid? You're not connecting the dots. Now, I imagine they're hanging onto the boat going, great lesson, fix the storm. And he's saying, I want you to get the word. So here's my challenge to myself and to you here this morning. Where in your life is there a crisis, or has there been a crisis where you want to fix and you want it now, and God is saying, I can fix it, but there's something more important. There's a concept, a word I'm trying to get across to you, and you're missing it. You're not getting it. If I fix it right now, you won't get it. So don't you often wonder, if God has this ability, and we pray, and I'm asking, why isn't He fixing it now? He doesn't ever seem to be on our timetable. He doesn't ever seem to be on my timetable. What's going on? One thing that's going on is He is saying, if I fix it on your timetable, you'll miss the point. And I'm driving that home, and I've got your attention. That's what He does. That's what He's doing. This is why Jesus has them in this position, and they're paying attention. Now, I've mentioned that I work with couples every week. I've had more men come in and hear what to do, and usually their wives are wanting them to listen and understand them. And as guys, you know, not our greatest asset usually. We're doers, we're problem solvers at work, and it's what we do. We fix things. So to hear and to listen is challenging to do. Wives are usually saying, I don't need you to fix it. I need to know you understand and care. That's kind of what they're after. As guys, we can miss that and miss that and miss that. But often, guys I work with, every year, guys will come home. And so if you think I'm talking about you, I'm not. Work with a lot of these cases every year. And the guy will come in to see me and he'll say, There was a note on the counter. She said she's gone. I didn't see it coming. She probably was telling him multiple times over a period of years, and he wasn't listening. And all of a sudden she says, I'm done, I'm out, and you know what that guy will do? I'm ready to work on it. The problem is, often by that time, a wife will say, I'm done. I was ready to work on it 5 years ago. We really need to listen. These fishermen needed to listen to Christ, and He's got their attention. Well, here's what He does, and I'll wrap up. He does fix it. He fixes it with a word, and He fixes it completely, and He fixes it immediately. Again, before I show you how He fixed that, the fix is not the point. The words He spoke is the point. What is Christ doing with these fishermen? I'll tell you what He's doing. I'm going to fast forward the story for you. These are the same guys that are going to reach the known world of Asia and turn it upside down. That's how effective they are. If they don't get this word from God, that you have little faith, if they don't become men of great faith, they're not going to affect anything. So that's what Christ is doing. He's taking them from being men of little faith to being men of great faith. I'll give you one example. And this is the power of God's Word. Peter, most of you are probably familiar with Peter. He was one of the fishermen. He had a pretty prosperous fishing business with James and John. Some rough guys. Their nicknames were Sons of Thunder. Pretty rough crowd. Peter is a confident guy in himself, and that's a problem. So at one point, Christ is telling these fishermen, you know, I'm going to go to this city, and I'm going to die, and and you guys are going to scatter. When the heat gets turned up, you're going to bolt. Peter says, not me. I won't bolt. He's not listening. Peter, who is saying these words to you? It's Jesus of Nazareth, and his content is infallible. Everything he says comes true. Everything, every time. Have you not picked up on that? When he tells a demon to leave, it leaves. When he tells a sickness to be gone, it's gone. You're not listening, Peter. I'm telling you, you're going to bail on me. And Peter, you ain't hearing him. Not me. All of them might, but not me. And Christ looks at him and says, before the morning, before the rooster crows, you will have bailed on me three times. Three times. And here's Peter's response. He still ain't listening. Not me. They might. I would die for you. Well, you probably know how that story goes. Christ's words have content and authority. It's exactly what Peter does. So once Jesus has their undivided attention, and he feels like they are getting the point that they are men of little faith, and he wants them to be men of great faith, now he fixes it. Now he fixes it. And here's how he does it. It's stunning. He stands up, and he looks at the storm raging. They're grabbing everything, grabbing the mast, grabbing. And he says, peace, be still. And it's gone. Instant calm. Not over an hour, instantly. If you're a professional fisherman and you see that happen, that's stunning. And it does stun them. And they say, who is this that even wind and waves obey what he says? Who is this? And we got a picture of who this guy is. I don't think we've got, this is a clear picture. Who does that? You know, he got them in their context, gave them a word and a work that stunned them. Absolutely stunned them. They do go on. In Acts 4, verses 1 through 31, jot that down or make a note. Peter, the same guy who didn't get it, on that boat in a desperate situation, because his life's in danger, he hears a word, and he gets the word because he's in a position to receive it. He's humbled. And then he sees Christ back up the word, back up the content with authority, and it transforms Peter's life. He is willing later to die and does for Christ. It's a guy who denied even knowing Christ around a campfire, even after saying he would never do that, and he goes to being a guy who is martyred for Christ. Radical change. What happened? How did that come about? Word and work. That situation in a crisis, spoken word by a man, Jesus, with massive authority, and it changed his life. I'll close with this. Jesus makes amazingly powerful statements all through the Bible. That's why I said it's the start. It's absolutely imperative that you decide what you believe about that Bible, because if it to you is good suggestions for decent living, then, all right, I'll take this, I'll chunk that. If you believe that Bible has the authority of a God who says a word and calms storms, then that's a different deal. So let me give you two statements that Jesus says to you, to me. He says, there is one way to be reconciled to God, and that's through me. I am the way, Jesus' words, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No man is reconciled to God except through me. These are very narrow, not politically correct words. What do you think about that? He goes on to say this in John 10:10. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that you might have life and have it to the fullest. So they're not empty words. Those are words spoken by a guy who cast out demons and calmed seas in an instant. What do you think about that? I don't know what, in your mind, it means to be a Christian. I'm going to have George come up in just a minute and walk you through filling out this card. If you have questions about what that means, or if you have questions about is the Bible valid, or if you have questions about and you want to meet with somebody, we would love to do that. But Jesus is saying things that are life-changing. And I know in the South it's popular, probably, if you grew up in the South, that, you know, pray this prayer and you'll be a Christian. You won't find that in the Bible. Walk this aisle, you'll fill out a card and you'll be a Christian. You won't find that in the Bible. Here's what Christ says in the same Gospel of Matthew. He says, here's what it is to be a Christian. Here's what it is to be a follower of Christ. It's like a man who went out into a field, who's just cruising through somebody else's field, stubs his toe on something, moves the dirt back. It's a box. It's a wooden box. He opens the lid, and in the box is $10 million of gold bars. Shut the box, put the dirt back over it. What would you do if that was you? I'd do what this guy did. Christ says that man would go and find out who owns the field. Hey, Joe, that's your field down there on the corner? Yeah. How much you want for that field? It's not for sale. If you were going to sell it, how much would you sell it for? It's not for sale. I don't want to sell it. What would you say the value is of your field, Joe? $5,000. I'll give you 10. Why would somebody do that? Because that guy knows that in that field is $10 million. And if he owns the field, he gets the gold. That's what it means to be a Christian. Christ is saying, I have treasure here. You're looking for treasure here. I want you to make a swap. What you believe about that changes everything or nothing about your life. It needs to be really clear. It's not about filling out a card. It's not about going to church. It's not about that. It's about, is Christ your treasure? If he's not, something's wrong. And you need to get that cleared up. George, let me invite you to come up, and would you just take a couple minutes, walk us through these cards, and help us see where we can go from here.